From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. For the first time in nearly 200 years, Pittsburghers have a single printed daily newspaper. The Pittsburgh Tribune Review's final paper was printed Wednesday, and a free online news service is being offered.
People want information immediately now. Then they want lots of information.
How are news organizations meeting the changing needs of their consumers? How is social media influencing news coverage? Will there be increased competition or partnerships?
There are definitely wonderful opportunities in this changing world. In addition to the competition, there's also an increasing collaboration among media.
We'll look at the evolution of the news media in Pittsburgh with a panel of six journalists. That's ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. Our weekly reporters roundup. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Greensburg Tribune Review moved into Pittsburgh market in May of 92 during the eight-month strike that halted printing of both the Afternoon Pittsburgh Press and the Morning Post Gazette. In January 93, the strike ended as the Block family, owners of the PG, acquired the press and then folded the press into the Post Gazette. The Pittsburgh Tribune Review remained in the market along with the Post Gazette. The final printed version of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review was published Wednesday, and the next day switched to a free, all-digital publication. So what will this mean to the Pittsburgh media landscape? During this program, we're going to explore that question and many others with a panel of journalists. Mila Sanina is the Executive Director of Public Source. Welcome, Mila. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Jeremy Boren is Digital Managing Editor for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Jeremy, good to have you here as well.
Thanks, Kevin.
Harold Hayes, retired broadcast journalist with KDKA-TV for 36 years. Harold, thanks for coming.
Keyword retired.
Ben Howard is Post Gazette's assistant managing editor for digital design. Ben, thanks so much.
Excited to be here.
And Charlie Deitch, editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we welcome Adam Schuck, creator of the e-newsletter Eat That, Read This, and also editor of the Glass Block. Adam, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Now, according to the records that I found, if you don't count that eight-month strike that I alluded to in 1992 and early 93, Pittsburgh has remained at least a two-newspaper, daily newspaper, town since at least the mid-1800s, longer than many other markets, bigger cities than Pittsburgh. Now, is that just sort of an interesting historical fact that doesn't mean anything anymore? Or is it even important with the changes in how people want to get and get their news, their information? Let's start with Jeremy.
I mean, I think it says something about people in Pittsburgh and their desire for a competitive news environment that gets the best stories all the time and a steady flow of them. So I think it's really a credit to a city, particularly in a media market this size, that it's been able to sustain two competing news organizations plus three TV stations, radio stations, and that there's a market and a desire for so many different sources of news. So I think it's a real compliment to Pittsburgh and the region.
Ben Howard?
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking the same thing. I was wondering what other, you know, media markets our size could have. I mean, we have six people here. We could have more, you know. There's a lot of other verticals out there that could, you know, we could have at this table. So, I agree. It's an exciting thing to be in Pittsburgh, and I think we're offering up a lot of knowledge here, a lot of news.
Charlie, is it exciting, as Ben suggests?
No, it is. And in fact, when I came to the city in 2000, there were also two alt-weeklies at that time. I worked for my competitor in Pittsburgh, Newsweekly, at the time. And it was, I mean, it was a really competitive news town then, and I think it's still competitive now, even though we've maybe lost some outlets. We've gained a lot of other online outlets that are keeping us on our toes. So.
Mila, how from the online public news service that you represent, that you offer, how do you perceive this and sort of the loss of a daily printed newspaper?
I think the means of news circulation have changed significantly. And just because, you know, the internet has been around for a very long time. I think the Post-Gazette launched its website in the mid-90s. So it's been around. And I think it the means of information traveling, you know, have changed significantly. So public sources, you know, using that and capitalizing on that. It also taught, you know, the emergence of social media and also is an additional, I guess, source of news circulation and very conducive environment for sharing information, especially Harold, in this market.
Oh, sorry. Harold, I wanted to get your sense here of, you know, being in this market for many years. I mentioned 36 years at KDKA TV. What sort of changes? I mean, was this a shock to you? Do you think it's going to have a major implication across the media landscape in Pittsburgh?
Well, to personalize it, my daughters who are 30 and 25 at this point do not subscribe to a written newspaper. They do not sit down at 6 o'clock at their dinner table and wait for the news to come on, and that's how they got their news. My household where I grew up, we did watch Bill Burns and waited till he came on to tell us what happened. We waited till 6:30 or 7 to see Walter Cronkite come on the CBS Evening News, and that dynamic has changed considerably. To personalize it again, when my kids read something online, I'm always telling them, please pay attention to who wrote it. You have potentially a million reporters out there who can get on social media and say a number of things, but whether what they're saying has any reflection, study, or truth to it is entirely another matter. And my concern, it's great that online is the way a number of people get their news, but there is pressure on all of us to make sure that people pay attention to where the information comes from, and I'm not sure that everybody does that.
Adam, I want to get your perspective on this in terms of you're back there sort of observing all of the media and how they present stories, how they cover stories, what stories they cover. If you'd give us your ideas on the impact of what happened this week regarding the Trib and its change, its transformation, and what that could mean for us positively or negatively.
I mean, from what I understand, we are still going to be having reporting coming out of the Trib, and we're still, yeah. I mean, there will still be Trib stories, Trib reporters, in addition to Post-Gazette stories and Post-Gazette reporters, and, you know, from all other outlets. To Howard's point, I'm not a print subscriber. I read everything online. I'm not sure what to expect, but I maybe won't see that much difference in what I'm consuming online from, you know, Trib Live. So, but I just wanted to speak to that point about the importance of readers paying attention to the byline, to who is reporting this, and not just, you know, what is the outlet, but who. I think, you know, a lot of us, and when I say us, maybe I mean millennials or people in my cohort, are reading news online and may also be following journalists on Twitter or on Facebook. And I think there's like a personality to that news delivery that is maybe a bit different, as opposed to, you know, the classic era of, you know, the talking head, you know, Peter Jennings. But I think, just to finish that point, I think being able to understand that who is delivering the news affects how that news is delivered and what the news is important.
Charlie.
Yeah, I think that it's obviously sad when we lose a print publication, but the important thing is that we keep the journalists, the seasoned journalists who know how to track down a story, who know how to write a story, who know how to responsibly present a story. That's what we need. I mean, the medium is going to change, but we have to make sure that we're keeping journalists, in the mix, providing the content, at least part of the content.
Ben Howard?
I was going to say, to Adam's point about following journalists, that building those relationships, and really that's building trust, I think that's what drives us forward. Like, we have so many issues right now with fake news and, you know, people, general distrust in the media. I think social media is actually, in that case, very powerful because you almost get to know these reporters, and in a way, but I think that's so important.
Mila.
I also think that it's the burden on the reader and the consumer. You have to be very educated in where the information is coming from and go an extra mile to know what the credible sources of information are. I think that today, a reader, Pittsburgh reader, you know, if he or she wants to be informed, it's going to different sources. And maybe, you know, like what Adam is doing is very helpful when he is aggregating and curating that content and adding some commentary to this. It's very helpful. But I do think that today, you know, the world of the parents, for example, when you used to get a newspaper and you have a you see a person reading the newspaper. The experience of consuming news online is much more intimate. You read it on smartphone, you read it on the screen. I think it's also the burden on parents to actually educate their kids on what sources of information to get and to read and what ones are credible and not. You know, to understand the dynamic and the anatomy of news is also important. When you read more than a headline, you know, you should understand that there are certain rules that journalists follow, attribution, you know, what are the sources, what is the linking, how do you gather information. These understanding this anatomy is very important. That's why, like Public Source, we are doing actually a course for community next Thursday on how to diagnose fake news and how to be an informed news consumer.
Okay. Jeremy, you want to chime in?
Yeah, and to her point, I mean, I think it's easier than ever to compare. You know, if you have the Post Gazette, the Trib, City Paper, Public Source, KDKA covering the same story as it often happens in this market, because the big stories are like a magnet, you can look at how the coverage works out. You can see, you know, what somebody got and what somebody didn't and how they approach the story, and you can really get kind of a 360 view of that. And you know, I think it says something that we're trying to meet those expectations of readers to have the ability and convenience to do those online stories in a rich, compelling way, and also be able to read them all kind of in the same format. And I think it says something too that pretty much everybody at this table, I think, spends most of their day producing content for something other than a printed newspaper, for the most part, I would say, or did anyway, mm-hmm. whether it's TV or the website.
Right. I want to get to bring up more on the fake news in just a second. Harold, you had something to add.
I was going to say something about the fake news.
All right,
the
go ahead,
other
please.
Element of that is that whoever did some research on the fake news found that there were more hits on to look at fake news articles than there were the real news articles, and that has a lot to do with many things. We saw it in TV that the more you sensationalize something, the more people would look at it. Didn't necessarily mean that it was well thought out.
Adam?
Yeah, I mean, I think to the point about fake news, you know, my concern actually is, yes, fake news is a problem, but, you know, if you read Adrian Chen's piece in The New Yorker the other day about that Washington Post, you know, Russian propaganda piece from last week, it rocketed around the internet. Everyone, you know, all sorts of high-profile journalists, you know, people at the Center for American Progress and, like, think tanks, everyone was sharing this piece. Because it spoke to, you know, this months-long Democratic Party establishment message, and it was a garbage article. And I think when the real news is fake news, that's a big problem.
Well, let's talk about that problem of fake news and how it can taint not just the originators of the fake news, because Mila was talking about, you know, you get your sourcing, your fact-checking, et cetera. But when it's learned by the consumers that, no, that was fake, that was false. I mean, are we concerned that there's the attitude, the reaction from the consumers, oh, that's all the media, they can't be trusted, or, you know, are they really doing it? Is that a concern, and how do we combat that if there's a concern? Jeremy, you were shaking your head.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a concern, and it's a huge challenge because it's so hard to undo it. I'm thinking of the first example that popped in my head was this tweet from a guy in Texas who saw the buses in, help me out, was it San Antonio?
It was Austin.
Or Austin, yeah, excuse me, thank you. And you know, the supposition he made in the tweet was that they were protesters being bussed in to protest against a Trump rally. I think it was still during the campaign. And that rocketed around the internet. A lot of people picked it up. A lot of, you know, supposed news sites, really, you know, conservative news sites picked it up and said, you know, see, here's proof, you know, that these are not real protesters. And it went everywhere. You know, the guy took steps to mark it as fake and all of that, but didn't get nearly as much traction. So I'm sure that most people who saw that still think it's true.
We're talking about the Pittsburgh media landscape and its future. I want to get to comments from Ben and Adam. Ben?
Yeah, sure. So like, trust, that's our main currency, right? I mean, that's people come to us because they believe what we're saying. I think that should be our main goal for 2017, is how do we build this stronger relationship with our audiences? How do you do that? I mean, that's a tough question. I think some of the steps Mila's taking with these community outreach programs where you're going in, actually talking to people, I think that's a step. Maybe something as simple as putting faces with names on your bylines, you know. Those sort of things that sort of bridge that gap between the reader and the writer. I think those sort of things can help us sort of get rid of this trust problem, maybe.
Adam Schuck?
Yeah, I think trust is, of course, certainly important. But, you know, I think another thing is that, you know, it's human psychology that, you know, people will consume, interact with, share, and believe stories that speak to their previously held beliefs. And so I think it is very important that we can also create a culture, maybe like two, you know, collective cultures, not like this is any new thing, of course, but, you know, watchdogs, people who are experts on media and can help explain, you know, I'm thinking of like, you know, the freedom and accuracy in reporting, you know, groups of media commentators and journalists who can help, you know, pick out red flags in problematic journalism. And the other thing, of course, is helping the readers, you know, be better educated and be better readers. That you know, is a big, it's a tall order.
Charlie Veach.
Our responsibility as journalists is we have to not get caught up in that. Because especially when we hit the time that we were not only competing with each other, we were competing with folks on social media and folks with blogs. And so we've always been told since we started this business, we need to be first, especially those of us, you know, who came up in daily newspapers. So now it's first takes on a whole new meaning. You want to be the first one to get that tweet out. So there are times that we've, you know, I'm sure all of us have probably thrown something out before we had, you know, before we had the fact, something we maybe wouldn't have put in a story, but because we're on the scene, we saw it, we maybe got, well, it's probably this, we talked about that. And so, you know, you put it up, but you have to not fall into that trap, because it's very easy to do when you want to be absolutely first.
Coming up, how does social media influence news coverage? We're going to talk more about that. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin, and we're speaking with a panel of journalists today about the changing media landscape in the Pittsburgh region in the wake of a major shift this week, the last printed edition of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review and the launch of a robust digital version of the Trib. Joining us in studio, Mila Sanina, Executive Director of Public Source, Jeremy Bourne, Digital Managing Editor of Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Harold Hayes, retired broadcast journalist with KDKA Television for 36 years, Ben Howard, Post-Gazette Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Design. Adam Schuck is the creator of the e-newsletter Eat That, Read This, and Charlie Deitch is editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper. There was one thing I wanted to ask upon. Ben brought up before the break, he was talking about something we need to work on in 2017, and that's trust. Is that part of the evolution? Since people have been saying, for instance, that certain types of media, newspapers and radio, are dying. Well, we're still here. 1949 Gallup poll, 1 in 4 people in the U.S. said that they thought radio was endangered, it was doomed because of, sorry, Harold, this onset of television. And according to Nielsen recently, radio has 240 million active users a month. Radio reaches 92%. This is where we were concerned, millennials, on a weekly basis. So what is the key here for all media? Is it a matter of evolving so we maintain our relevancy and we can still fulfill our news missions? Yeah, Ben.
I think it's knowing your audience, getting to know what they want, what they're interested in reading. I think that's an important step.
Anybody else? Harold?
Well, when we talked about trust, and obviously we have to deal with, and I'm not really in it. I peripherally get into it once in a while. But the issue of trust goes back to something we said earlier, dealing with the immediacy of what you can do in the media now and how quickly you can get a story on. And I just recall that back in the old days, if we had something exclusive at KDKA, you held it no matter when you learned it.
Until, and you promoted it.
Until we promoted it. Wait till you see Harold's story. Of course, right. Sometimes in promotion, I'd hear what they said about my story. That isn't my story. But you held it until the big show at 6. Well, again, my kids don't sit around and wait till 6 o'clock. There's a great pressure to, on Twitter, once you've learned something, even if it's 11:13 in the morning, you get that on Twitter. And then there's the pressure of, well, Channel 11 is saying such and such. And I'm saying, well, I'm there. I don't know that that's the case. But there's this great pressure to put something on immediately, which takes away the reflection that you may have had to wait a while, really get out the, you know, flesh out what has really happened in context. But then you look at the audience, and sometimes the audience isn't looking for context. They just want to know, what is it that happened, and what can you tell me right now? And what you can tell them right now might be a deep thought. It may not be, but everybody wants something right now, and it takes away from your time to be able to reflect.
Well, let me follow up with Adam. We were talking before the break also about social media and traditional media, and Harold was just relaying about, you know, when stories, when information was released, do you hold it? Now you've got to get it out there, at least a mention, and hope that somebody will come to your website online, somebody will tune in that broadcast, somebody will pick up the paper the next day or whatever, coming to your medium. So to what extent, Adam, do you think is social media driving not just when stories are released or revealed, but what stories are covered and even how they're covered? Do you think they are?
You know, I can't say I'm too sure. I've never worked in a newsroom before. Mm-hmm. I've never felt the pressures of, you know, how do we seed this out? You know, what I do day to day is pull together what's been written into a newsletter that goes out at a certain time, a time at which I know and my subscribers know, you know, this is coming. I know what I'm going to be getting. I can unsubscribe at any time if I'd like to, instead of having to, you know, pick through a stream that's like a fire hose to the face. And I, you know, Twitter, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, but, you know, Facebook, shady algorithms, I don't know what I'm seeing, what I'm not seeing. Twitter, it's way too much all at once and I get lost. And so I can't rely on Twitter. So I see the newsletter as an example of that kind of like sized, you know, delivery system that I think is ideal.
Yeah, Charlie Deitch.
Yeah, we definitely feel like we, you know, we look at numbers, we try and figure out, you know, what kind of stories play on what platforms. But I will say that Adam's newsletter drives a whole lot of traffic to our site. I mean, that's something we look at and we watch and something we're very appreciative of, which is why if he ever calls up and says, hey, could I use a picture? Could I use this? Absolutely. Because I think you have to collaborate in that way. And a lot of like, you know, sort of making your stuff available to other outlets, you know, maybe someone you're not in direct competition with, but somebody that you can help each other. I think those are the kind of things that that help drive traffic to our website and traffic to our social media.
Mila?
Well, I think I'm the first person to say that social media is great for personalizing and being in contact with a reporter. But I do think that it does, unfortunately, dilute the power of storytelling and just in-depth journalism, just because we are very reactionary when we cover stories. And that does not, you know, what Harold was saying, it does not give you enough time to really contemplate what is the meaning of this story long-term? What is the meaningful and relevance of my reporting? You know, as a person, I think that our industry is having an existential crisis, not just in Pittsburgh, nationwide, just because of how do we prove our indispensable role in the society. You know, as a person who was born in the Soviet Union, I just think that to truly make America great, you need to do good journalism and respect it and do not waste the First Amendment and be, you know, be doing public service journalism that could make a difference and could make society better, be more contemplative about the changes, about where are we going, where are we now, who we are. I think that social media dilutes it because in a way, you know, it's race to the bottom. We all chase the same stories without really stepping back and saying, you know, How is that fitting the larger picture? Is that, you know, just one crime, one homicide? What does it tell you about what is happening to the crime dynamic in the city, in the larger state? I think that this, we should, you know, be much more respectful of the time of our readers and also be stepping back more and thinking about in depth and what we are doing for our community and the society at large.
Jeremy Bourne.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And that's one of the exciting things about being able to dedicate all of our resources at Trib Live to an online platform is that, you know, it's a bit of inside baseball, but one of the realities of having a print product is you have an A section, you have a B section, and so on, and you need a certain number of stories to fill it each day, no matter what. And so at some time, you know, at times it's a great motivator to go out and find stories that you might have otherwise, you know, sat back on or something like that. But, you know, sometimes it's a great challenge. And so if you don't have a certain number of spots all of a sudden, and you can really step back and focus on stories that you think readers care about, that you really want to dig into, you have the opportunity to do that because on the web, we can have a certain number of stories one day and a totally different number the next day, and it's not a problem.
Harold Hayes?
And in broadcasting, one of the issues is that the, again, going back to a Walter Cronkite world where CBS puts 30 minutes of news, the 30 minutes of what really was relevant that day, as compared to news that starts at 8 in the morning and is on 24/7 and anything that happens immediately is we just learned that such and such has happened, and then you're on for an hour with people speculating about what's really going on. That affects the general population's view of, I think some things get aggrandized that aren't really as big a deal because it's over by such and such a time. It, you know, by the time Pittsburgh sends a reporter to Columbus, and I'm not denigrating the concern about what would happen at Ohio State University,
right,
because there are people from here whose kids go to Ohio State University. But very frankly, by noon it was over. There are things you need to look at in terms of who did it and why. But by the time most Pittsburgh reporters got to Columbus, it was over before they got on the parkway. But we fill that broadcast time with something that is, you call it sensationalism, but it's something people are interested in. But when you look at it and step back at the end, what did you really accomplish by going there?
Right.
You pretty much got what everybody else had.
A couple of the characteristics we've talked about so far during the program regarding the media's trust, relevancy. So I want to pose this to you. In the past, politicians relied on the media to sort of be a conduit for their message, and then the reporters would provide the context, get reaction, etc. And now, President-elect Trump, for example, is sort of bypassing or attempting to bypass the media. going directly to his audience. The people want to hear from him to get his message out, but get his message out the way he wants to get it out, and any politician doing the same thing. So it's sort of, shall we say, maybe even informational sleight of hand. Here, listen to this, and I'm not going to tell you about that, and not talking about it. So what position does that put the media in? Do we have to reestablish our role? Do we have to reestablish our value to the audiences we serve? Anybody?
Well, it's one thing to...
Harold?
It's one thing to... where a presidential candidate or a mayor or a governor or a city councilman put something out on Twitter, this is what I'm saying, and then that's all you get. There's however many words you get on Twitter, that's it. And you don't have an ability to question that beyond what Twitter says. And you're right, just because it's on Twitter, that's what he wants you to know, but there has to be an opportunity for the journalist to question what it is you're saying, put it in context, and Twitter doesn't give you that.
But if politicians don't hold news conferences either to ask them directly, yeah, Jeremy, then Adam.
But even if they do, I mean, I think we've all seen times when a politician or somebody else has held a news conference and refused to take any questions. And so, yes, you have them in person and you might shout a question that they don't answer. And so you can say that you asked it, but is it any better than, you know, seeing something on Twitter and not having the ability to question it there? I mean, I think it presents a bigger challenge. And I mean, it also raises questions about why the information was put out that way, that journalists can ask about and scrutinize, that this is a message that, you know, you didn't want any chance of anybody asking questions about. Why is that? You know, to me, it might elevate the story and get more attention and have sort of the opposite effect that maybe somebody putting it out on their own would want.
Adam Schuck.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to add, I think it's really important that we need to recognize this. There's a strong political component here. It's not just about media, but it's about politics. It's about, right, you know, the fact that President-elect Trump is, you know, pulling from a vast reserve of right-wing populist anger at the media. In the rise of the Third Reich, you know, I'm going to break Godwin's law, but, you know, we had Lügenpresse, right? We had this, like, slanderous term against what was seen as this, like, liberal, intellectual establishment media. So in some ways, you know, it, you know, Trump, what Trump's saying, it doesn't matter what the reports are. It's just this punching bag that he's put out that is, you know, stoking this kind of anger at the media. But I think the other thing to note is that, you know, if we're looking at the way that, you know, the mainstream media, the New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, you know, responded to Trump's campaign, a lot of it was, because so many of these journalists are, you know, sectored off in these urban enclaves, they were not connected to the way that what Trump was saying was connecting to the electorate and the people who voted for him. I mean, Christian Parenti, he's a New York University professor, had a really great piece on his blog, it's now in Jacobin magazine, about basically the entire media establishment caught on to these really, really flashy, like, horrific statements, and then ignored everything that was between the lines that people were really tapping into. So I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with this, but I think, you know, we need to recognize that this is a political moment and not just what can the media do.
I want to get to Charlie, but to be fair, Donald Trump supporters have said, look, you're not covering his selections, his process, whether it's the transition or his selections for cabinet positions, fairly. And so we're going to just bypass you. We're just going to listen to what our president-elect, whom we supported, we voted for, said. So that's the reaction. I mean, it comes into the newsroom. I'm sure it's come into all of your newsrooms about, you know, are you doing it a fair job? And it's always the question, are you doing a fair job? Charlie.
Well, during the campaign especially, it comes down to the individual and their sensibilities. They decided that a lot of the absurd, just whacked out statements that Donald Trump made, they believed, and they weren't going to take, you know, any kind of, you know, they were going to take the media's word for those people who believed Donald Trump and some of the absurd things he said. They were going to believe it regardless. What the media's problem was, I think, is we have a way of working those things. A politician says something, we go out and we try and fact check it. We see if it's true. we had to make the decision early on that we're not going to spend our time fact-checking these ridiculous claims. I mean, in City Paper, we have a little more latitude than the dailies do because people have an expectation of what we do and kind of where we're coming from. So we have that ability. And so we just stopped doing that. In fact, to sort of announce that, when Donald Trump was in town and he made the comment about Joe Paterno, I wrote a 500, 600 word fact check on the fact that Joe Paterno is in fact dead. But that was kind of my thing to say, look, we're not going to continue. We're not going to just take these absurd statements and take them as fact and waste our time doing that when there's so much other stuff for us to cover in this situation.
All right. Ben.
I was going to say, that's like the whole topic right now is, do we ignore Trump's tweets? And man, if you can't look at the President of the United States tweets, like who can you report on? I mean, that's, what are you supposed to do? I mean, that puts us in a really tough position, I think.
I think that we have to pay attention to them, but I also think that, you know, when we present that information, I think it's how we present that information. And I think that even, you know, our most venerable daily outlets, I think you have to just stand up and say, this is just ridiculous, and you know, present it as such in some way. It's changing. Donald Trump changed the way that we report the news, especially in national campaigns, and we have to accept that, and we have to kind of move with that. Again, I know it was easier with us, you know, being more of a left-leaning paper to do that, but I think a lot of other outlets need to get onto that, I think.
Mark, Harold Hayes.
And I think beyond Trump and beyond Twitter, I've just, looking at it as long as I have, see more statements come from either politicians or entities or corporate entities that just send out a statement rather than give you the access to the CEO of the company or the person responsible for this, whether it's a politician or whether it's a corporate head. And their statement is, this is what we have to say, period. There are no people who are going to be put out there so that you can question them, and here's what we have to say, period, and you're left with that. And I just see that more and more, and that might be a reflection of a general perception of the media, or people have something to hide, but I see more statements written than I do people available to talk to.
Mila.
I also think that the strategy of Trump's campaign and his use of Twitter has disrupted the way the media usually operates. And, it's sort of like it was an interesting, I think, juxtaposition of how reactionary the media has become and how Trump has used his Twitter to amplify his message. Because Twitter is actually not that widely used. It's we in the media who use it a lot. But there are very interested, demographics. And then when you write headlines that are not evidence-based but accusations-based, you actually amplify the message. So I think that even Washington Post and the New York Times, as much as they have done a great job in, covering Trump later on, they haven't figured out their strategy early enough, I think. And to make it more relevant and I think, more fact-check based, it was too late to be doing that. All of that being said, I do think that social media does have this effect that hasn't been touched upon on this, living in your own bubble, right? Again, this is the burden on the reader to get out of your bubble, to look at the views that are not really representative of your own, a very tight circle of people you talk to. Because I think that there are demographics that we, in the urban core, we think, okay, well, there are people who are not being heard, who are not being, whose issues should be covered more. But there are also other people that are not maybe living in the urban core, but also consider themselves forgotten America. And I think as a media entity, we should be very sensitive to that. I'm not saying that we should, don't take my statement as a justification for all this bigotry or, accusation against racism, accusation against free press, and all of that. I just think that as a listeners, and we should be listening to the constituencies whose needs are not being addressed.
Coming up, collaboration versus competition. as we continue on this special edition of The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about Pittsburgh's changing media landscape in the wake of the final printed edition of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review this week. And we're discussing all that with our panel, Adam Schuck, creator of the newsletter Eat That, Read This, Charlie Deach, editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper, Ben Howard is Post-Gazette assistant managing editor for digital design, Harold Hayes is a retired broadcast journalist from KDKA-TV, and Jeremy Bourne, digital managing editor, Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and also Mila Sanina, executive director of Public Source. In the final printed edition of the Pittsburgh Trib, Luis Fabregas talked about the digital version. He said, quote, "Our content will be more focused on areas that have defined us, politics, healthcare, technology, and crime, to name a few, end quote. So I'm just wondering, your thoughts, will we narrow our focus of areas of coverage and really go in depth there or not? Or are we still going to be all things to all people, all readers, all consumers? Ben?
I think we should, absolutely. I mean, at least at the PG and Trib used to be, that was our, it's like everything, reporting everything there is to report in town. And in that way, we're sort of competing with Google and Facebook, and we're never going to win that battle. We just don't have that manpower. So I think maybe getting to know our readers a little bit better, like I was saying earlier, building those things like trust and relationships could help us figure out what it is we do best and what it is we can offer that nobody can get anywhere else. And that's a real challenge.
Yes, Adam.
We also need people like you to cover, you know.
Oh, no, I'm not saying stop doing the important stuff at all. I mean, that's our First Amendment. That's what we have to do. But maybe I'm saying that we should be doing more of that.
Yes, Mila.
I also think that journalism should be needs-based, and it goes to what Ben was saying about understanding your audiences. But also, if you just look at the traffic numbers, right, if that's your only measure, then we all would turn into covering Steelers and talking about Ben Roethlisberger's meniscus all day long, right? So I think that it really is important to be doing the journalism that makes us indispensable. Like, you know, if, for example, if the Trib goes away, the Post-Gazette goes away, or Public Source goes away, or Eat That, Read This goes away, City Paper, like, what would happen then? I think that, you know, we should be doing the work that makes a claim that we are indispensable. And there are a lot of areas for improvement. I think that's needs-based journalism, understanding the needs of our audience and how Pittsburgh and our community could be better is critical.
Well, let me bring in Jeremy here, since I cited Luis's comment there in that final printed edition. So do you find your areas of coverage, will they be sharpened, fewer, or do you think you'll be still covering the same things but slightly different? How are you going to approach it?
No, I think that's a good word, sharpened. And those kind of, you know, core areas that he's talking about relate back to the reporters in our newsroom and what their areas of specialization are. You know, our political reporter, Tom Fontaine, he's going to focus on politics, as he has, you know, during this latest presidential campaign. That's going to be one of the core areas that he's going to continue to report on because he has that experience. So that's what he's talking about there. That's the expertise that we bring to readers. That's the type of stuff that you can't find anywhere else. And that's what readers want, is stories that they can't find elsewhere. So I don't know that, you know, as Harold was saying earlier, that it necessarily serves a readership if we all do the same car crash coverage every day. And, you know, I'm not saying that it doesn't deserve some coverage, but not the kind of like repetitive coverage that that often you see, and because it all ends up being a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah, Harold Hayes.
One thing the internet has done, and I just go back to broadcast days, you can, we only, way back in the old days, you'd find out what people were really watching based on phone calls you'd get, letters you'd get. Now you instantaneously know because you get hits on the website. And one of the reasons you see so many Ben stories is because those are the hits they get on the website. And I agree. I hope we're not at the point where Ben's anatomy is all we cover. But you have to, I remember
Ben Roethlisberger.
Ben Roethlisberger, right. But I remember the day that he had the motorcycle accident at the end of the 10th Street Bridge.
Right.
We were on live. We preempted the Young and the Restless.
Oh, my.
And we're on live for 2.5-3 hours going from Lynn Hayes Freeland at the hospital to me at the police station to John Shumway at the scene saying nothing. I mean, we said, yeah, this is all we know. And the thing that scared me was the ratings for that 2 hours that we did it went up exponentially. It was probably bigger even than the nightly news coverage that day. So it is in an era where we're doing more collaboration and the media is asked to do more with less, the media will, or media managers are going to pay very close attention to what people are watching.
I do want to talk a little bit about collaboration. We just have a few minutes remaining. Mila, so you collaborate with printed newspapers, Public Source, to get stories, more exposure in other outlets. And I remember WESA collaborated with the Tribune Review on a particular story on smart electric meters. Does anybody expect more collaboration? Do we need a greater collaboration amongst all the media sources? I'll start with you, Mila.
I hope we are much more collaborative in the years to come, just because you see that partnerships, meaningful partnerships, do work. And, when I had a chance to go to and visit a newsroom that is looked at as a nonprofit journalism sort of model, and it's Texas Tribune, and they have done some amazing work with newspapers, with outlets such as ProPublica and others, where you bring in talent and strengths, and that partnership really becomes meaningful beyond just reprinting and taking each other's, articles. I think that when you have different skill sets and different experiences, that collaboration and partnerships can be very fruitful and can actually create stories that would be both beneficial for the community and for the publications that we're talking about.
All right. We all love in-depth journalism, but I'm going to give you each 20 seconds to answer the final question. So putting aside the end of the daily printed trib, a sort of introspective question. Finally, what has been lacking in the media in the Pittsburgh region? But looking ahead, what can we do better? We'll go around the table. We'll start with you, Ben.
Oh, man.
20 seconds, Ben.
20 seconds. 30 seconds, go. I think I'll keep banging on this thing I've been talking about building relationships, getting into the community, really putting those faces on our in our stories, on our website, talking to people and building trust.
Okay, 15 seconds to Harold. He took five of yours.
The broadcast guy gets condensed. I could tell you very easily, not just talk about what happened, but try to do a better job about telling why it happened.
Jeremy.
Yeah, I agree with both of those, actually. Giving the context, building relationships with readers, I think it's extremely valuable. Yeah.
Boy, you guys are getting good at this 20-second business. Charlie Deitch, you get an extra two.
Yeah, I think that it's important to I agree with everything they've said, but also you need to know your readers, but then you need to make sure that once you know them, you need to keep giving them what they want and not give in to outside pressures like advertising dollars and so forth. You have to keep focused on your readership in order to succeed.
Adam Shuck, what do you want to be done better by the media?
Well, despite the importance of social media being succinct and at a quick clip, I think it's important that the articles themselves should have historical context, be a little more in-depth, and allow someone who's coming to this story, which might be an ongoing thing for the first time, to have all the context immediately.
And very briefly, Mila.
I think we need to train storytelling muscle of our community, burst bubbles, and listen.
Thank you so much. That's Mila Sanina, Executive Director of Public Source, Jeremy Bourne, Digital Managing Editor, Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Harold Hayes, retired broadcast journalist, Ben Howard, Post-Gazette Assistant, Managing Editor for Digital Design, Charlie Deitch is editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper. Adam Shuck is the creator of the newsletter Eat That, Read This. And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together. WESA's director of engineering is Russ Lloyd. Our studio engineer, Tom Hurley. Production assistance from Vince Balestrino. The producer of the program is Marcus Charleston. Thanks to all of our great guests today, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.